Good afternoon. I'd like to open the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency this February 7th, 2013. Committee, we have our first public hearings coming up today, and I know Representative Nathanson is here and ready to go. So I'm going to open a public hearing for House Bill 2140, House Bill 2141, House Bill 2142, and House Bill 2143. Representative Nathanson. Good afternoon, welcome, and I know your time is very precious today and every day, and so I wanted to open up all the hearings so you could talk about any of those bills that you wanted to, since you've had some interest in those of sorts.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. In 2009, when I first started working on state and county shared services, there was something I noted back at that time. Remember, this is a few years ago now. I said, the economic crisis facing Oregon and its 36 counties is not a matter of short-term cash flow. There's probably not a feasible way to raise enough new revenue to solve the budget gaps. And even if the federal timber payment problem didn't exist, we'd still have a problem. Well, now in 2013, the county payments issue is still upon us. Several counties are in fiscal distress with urgent budget crises and imminent shutdowns, and the state is in no position to simply hand out cash. Our system of delivering services, policing jails, ensuring clean water, protecting children, taking care of seniors, so many of the services we have are actually shared. The state has some role in delivering the services as well as local governments. Sometimes it can take, from the legislative fiscal office, three or more fiscal analysts to just come and report on different departments and different ways in which the state and local government is putting money into a service. So add that onto the 36 counties each having their own particular budget and departmental arrangements, and it gets pretty complex and confusing. In just one program area, there's a report titled An Analysis of Oregon's Alcohol and Drug Treatment and Prevention System. It explains that there are multiple agencies involved, different data systems, duplicate data entry, and that places a subsequent burden on all the providers. And then add on to that, that was just at the county level, all of that lack of coordination. Add on to that the counties and the local governments, and it was pretty complicated. So the point is, in some cases, our bureaucracy is not necessarily facilitating and streamlining to improve services. It's actually sort of the weight of it is pulling us down. The State and Local Government Efficiency Task Force convened several subcommittees over the past year and a half in program areas such as human services, criminal justice, and natural resources. State and local officials, that would be elected officials and professionals, looked throughout there are service areas where interagency bureaucracy needed to be straightened out. A total of 12 recommendations were developed by that group and 7 specific bills, and your committee will be hearing several of those bills this session. Government efficiency isn't simply about automating existing procedures. It can be about changing the procedures, not just putting a computer program on top of what people are already doing. So in some cases, you're going to see we're cleaning out the closet, getting rid of something we don't need anymore. In other cases, we need more comprehensive restructuring. Where more than one agency is involved in a service, we need to ask why. What is the reason behind it? Is there a way we can do it better? But we can't do that simply by just convening a state or group, and we can't just say we're leaning on the counties only to solve this. The point is, working together, it's going to take us together figuring out how to fix some of those tangled up procedures. And so that's what this task force was looking at. Today, you won't see any vast sweeping restructuring proposals. You will see four very modest and effective ways of tackling government efficiency, each one of them small, but collectively, the more we do of this, the better it is for everybody, local and state government. So we continue looking for the low-hanging fruit. For example, two of them are cleaning out the closet. That's going to be the outdated county treasurer statutes and the county fairgrounds statute. One is to remove redundant procedures. That's the jail audits bill. And the other approach is collaborating with local government for everyone's benefit. We're not getting rid of something. We're actually enabling local government to take advantage of something to help local government. But of course, when we can help the counties, that helps us. It's all of our constituents. That bill is about the investment pool. A particular proposal may seem to benefit the state or to benefit the county, but please keep in mind the point was a group of state and county officials came together to make these joint proposals because we recognize it benefits everybody to do this. You will have people here to testify on each specific bill. I'm not going to testify on each bill for you specifically because that would just repeat what they're going to do. With one exception, however, on the jail audits bill, there's an issue that came to our attention after the task force completed its work. In fact, it just came to our attention in the past week or so. It relates to public access to information that has been developed in these jail inspections. I have reviewed once again the information from the subcommittee and from the task force. It does not seem that the issue of public records was discussed. The issue that was discussed was duplication of the inspection. We had a county process for inspecting over 300 things about jail condition, and we have a state inspection procedure that inspects only 14 points. So the proposal was to get rid of the less thorough state inspection or audit and to retain the county one. There was nothing ever discussed about taking a step backward in access to public information. So I have asked for an amendment to be prepared to ensure that there is at least the same amount of public information available with regarding to those inspections as has been the case up till now. In other words, we're not trying to take a step back. Let's make sure that it remains at least as it is now. It will also make a clarification. When we read the statute more carefully and the work of the task force, this was only about removing DOC inspection of county jails. DOC also is responsible for inspecting other local facilities like temporary lockups, juvenile detention facilities, and city jails. And this proposal is intended to address only that duplicate county inspection. And we want that to be very clear for you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your work on the Government Efficiency Task Force and really helping us through that with your role in both the Ways and Means process and working together with this committee. These are sometimes really boring issues, but really somewhat important. So I appreciate your efforts on that. Is there any quick questions for Representative Nathanson so she can get back to her budgets? Thank you very much again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So with that, I think we're going to go forward with one bill at a time as I opened up all of the hearings on the first four. So I'm going to close, and we will come back to them. I'm going to close House Bill, the public hearing on House Bill 2141 and House Bill 2142 and House Bill 2143, which leaves House Bill 2140 still open. So we're going to go to that list. And up for testimony, we have Mike Eliason and Lori Steele. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Mike Eliason, Association of Oregon Counties. We're happy to be here in support of House Bill 2140, which, as Representative Nathanson stated, is a product of the Government Efficiency Task Force. This bill simply basically provides another option for local governments with a sizable reserve fund that they're comfortable investing with a little bit longer-term perspective, the same opportunity that currently exists for the state and the university system. So it's basically just opening up this particular pool to local governments, including school districts, community colleges, special districts, and cities. This would allow, as I said, counties to possibly diversify their portfolios to potentially earn a slightly better rate of return on their portfolio. At this point, we've only identified a couple of counties who are probably going to participate in the short term, but as this fund becomes more, this pool becomes more well-known and establishes more of a track record, it's conceivable that more counties would want to participate. It's probably best suited to the handful of counties out there right now who have a sizable road fund reserve. There aren't many, and they're starting to obviously become less and less over time, but there are still a decent number of counties that have a pretty significant road fund reserve that may be interested in participating in this pool. So with me is Marion County Treasurer Lori Steele, who's also a member of the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board, and I would turn it over to her if she has any comments as well.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good
Welcome.
Afternoon, Chair Holvey. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm here today to represent the Oregon Association of County Treasurers. I did poll the county treasurers asking...
Could identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Lori Steele. I am the Marion County Treasurer. I did ask the county treasurers of any interest that they might have in investing in the intermediate term pool, and because of there's so little that we know about it, since it's not been available in the past, there hasn't been a lot of interest up front, but as Mr. Eliason said, the more we learn about it, the more interest I'm sure there will be. We are interested in working very closely with the State Treasurer's Office to make sure there are adequate controls in place and training in place so that local governments that do have an interest investing in this pool understand the parameters, understand the risks, and identify only those funds that could be invested for a longer period of time. So I'm very interested in working with the State Treasurer's Office and in developing those controls.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the staff measure summary and also on the agenda, the word discrete is used. Authorizes discrete investment. Can you help me understand what the word discrete means?
Chair Holby, Representative Smith. That's a great question. I don't know specifically why that particular word was picked by legislative council. It wasn't necessarily submitted as, you know, a word-for-word request that it be worded that way. I know representatives from the State Treasurer's Office are here, and they may have a little bit more, may be able to shed more light on why that particular word was used, but I can't answer that question at this time. I'd be happy to find out.
With that, I'd ask the State Treasurer's Office if they're willing to come up and maybe try to field that question for us.
I just don't understand what it means.
Hey, it's a good question. I like to think my funds are discreet as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the State Treasurer's Office. The reference to discreet investments means any investment not in the Oregon Short-Term Fund. The idea is that the Short-Term Fund is essentially the default fund for a hodgepodge of different funds and accounts. The there's a reference to discrete investments in ORS 294 that clarifies that any fund that has an explicit authority to be invested discreetly may then be invested discreetly, and any fund that does not have that explicit authority may not be and will find its way into the short-term fund. Now, I know that the 294 also gives local governments and counties that explicit authority to invest, and thusly they may invest discreetly. And for the record, and to be very clear, that's oh, I'm going to try to spell now, D-I-S-C, wait, no, this, now I'm just embarrassing myself. the discreet, not the homonym meaning subtle, but the word discreet meaning separate.
Separate. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You bet. Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is moving very quickly. I have some concerns because I'm not sure why is this coming up now? Why was there this grant not given before? Was there a policy reason as to why this authority was not given to local government in the past? So can you expand on that?
Chair Hovey, Representative Richardson, I'll take a stab at that. I know that this is a concept that has been discussed for several years at the Oregon Association of Counties, and it has been something we've debated and kicked around and maybe even put forward as a legislative concept in the past. I'm not sure if it ever got that far. But with the economy where it is today, the limitations on the short-term fund that we have by statute, we can only invest today, it's $44.999 million in the short-term fund. We are finding ourselves with fewer and fewer options available. The banks no longer want large deposits on account because of the FDIC insurance cap now, and it's becoming more difficult to invest funds. The intermediate term pool is available to the state, and it is earning a better rate than I could go if I were going to go out and purchase a four-year investment on the market. I could get a better rate at the intermediate term fund.
Okay. May I continue?
Certainly.
Okay. I understand why you want to do it. You'd like to get a better return. But this is being asked for in 2013. These funds have been in existence for a long time. Is there a reason why this authority has not been granted in the past? Who would be speaking against allowing this to take place?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Richardson, the intermediate term pool is a pooled fund that was actually only set up by the state treasurer's office in 2010. So the although there has been the pooled fund of the Oregon short-term fund, which contains within it the local government investment pool, long before that, those allowances were already existed in statute, and the intermediate term pool is a relatively new creature.
May I just continue?
Certainly. Okay. Continue.
Thank you. So why was local government not included in 2010? They just somebody just missed it, or was there a reason that you were aware of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, members of the committee, the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool is not a specific creature of statute. It's a construction of the Treasurer's Office. So the existing statute merely made this list in ORS 294.035 of acceptable investments, and at the time, the only pooled fund run by the state treasury which would have been an appropriate investment was the local government investment pool, which was specifically called out. Now that the intermediate term pool has been created, there is another pooled fund available, and I believe the intent of House Bill 2140 is now to hook into that, to add that to the list of acceptable investments. Prior to the fund being created, there is no reason that list would include the intermediate term pool or any similar reference.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony today on this bill, and just note that it is not my intention to move this particular bill today.
Thank you.
So with that, coming up next is Rob Wagner and David Terry or Perry. Welcome. welcome, gentlemen. If you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, for the record, I'm Rob Wagner, representing Portland Community College.
That's okay.
I know time is limited, and you have several bills of consideration before the committee today. I'll be introducing David Terry, who's PCC's internal auditor, to talk about how we discovered this pool was available for investment purposes. And echoing Michael on this earlier, the Oregon University system has used this pool with great effect the last couple years, and I think it's consistent with the 40-40-20 vision of the state of Oregon, and with the governor releasing his capital list just 2 days ago, looking at similar treatment between the universities and community colleges, which we believe would extend to our ability to maximize the investment of taxpayers for public funds in our bond investments. So, regardless of whether or not you're a university or a community college, it makes sense for taxpayers to be able to maximize that return on the public's dollars. So one final point I wanted to put out there for the record is there was some initial question about whether community colleges are reflected in the definition of local government funds under ORS 294. And working with your talented and handsome committee administrator, Legislative Council has confirmed that community colleges do fit under that statutory definition. And I wanted that as just part of the public record in case regarding legislative intent, in case there was any question going further. I think he's been through this hoop, but Mr. Salvaggio has commented to me as well that it's my understanding that the treasurer's office would look at this to be able to, for community colleges to be able to access the fund as well. So with that, I'll turn over to David for more official testimony.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Terry, internal auditor for Portland Community College. I'm testifying today for your positive consideration of House Bill 2140, which, if passed, would allow community colleges in Oregon to be able to legally invest in the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool. Some background on why the change in the statute would benefit Oregon's community colleges, the state's economy, and the effective investment of state and local funds are that, for example, in 2008, voters across the PCC service district approved a $374 million bond for new building construction, renovations, and safety upgrades. In 2011, I conducted an internal audit of PCC's bond program and found that PCC is restricted by current state statutes and certain types of investments that they can utilize. Those are the Oregon Short-Term Fund, Short-Term Fixed Income Investments, CDs, and Checking and Savings Account. The best rate of return that we realized during that year was approximately 1.25%. However, similar education institutions like the Oregon University System can and do invest in the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool, which had a better rate of return than the investment options available to PCC. PCC's bond was the largest bond in the state history at that time. Given this large capital campaign, the PCC bond program is planned to span 9 years to spend down all the bond funds. However, the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool would have been, the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool would have been an investment option PCC could have taken advantage of, like OUS could and still can. And some advantages to that would be, one, to better diversify the investment of the bond funds; two, to generate increased investment returns due to the longer term of investment; and three, to allow PCC management to use those increased investment returns to invest strategically in the local economy and projects that may benefit the governor's 40-40-20 goals. So my estimate, if PCC were to invest $50 million into the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool, then approximately $2.25 million more in investment return would be realized per year. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I appreciate you being conscious of our time, as we do have a long list. Representative Smith, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if you gentlemen are the right ones to answer this question. I'm trying to get my arms around this issue still. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hearing discussion on a greater potential return on our deposits. I haven't heard yet any discussion on the increased level of risk that might occur. Can you folks address that, or
that was one of my questions as well.
If someone could help me understand that.
Okay, I'll take a stab at it. So Chair Halvey and Representative Smith. So the way I would describe the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool is it is basically like the Oregon Short-Term Fund, except it's longer duration investments. And Mike can maybe add some more.
That's what I'll turn over to the treasurer's office.
A true pro handing it off quickly. Mr. DeBaggio, if you'd reintroduce yourself for the record again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the State Treasurer's Office. The good representative is absolutely correct. With additional returns comes either additional risk or additional term of investments. And that's one of the reasons that the State Treasury maintains the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool at the discretion of the State Treasurer, in that we do not simply open that up for any agency or entity to put their funds in it like a normal checking account. We do have an application process. We do strive to make certain that any depositors know that these are longer-term investments. They will go up and down. They will fluctuate more than an investment in the short-term fund. No investments without risk, and no investments going to say that it's absolutely risk-free. We do say that you're not going to have as free access to your money, because there's a month-long or up to a month-long process for withdrawals. There will be some times where explaining what I'm recalling from the prospectus here, which is available on the Treasurer's website. There are going to be occasions where the maximum number of shares allowed to be liquidated at the month's end might be limited upon the size of the pool, may be subject to change. This is a higher yield investment vehicle. That's the idea. So,
just one last one.
Okay.
Just one last one, Mr. Chair, and then I'll stay quiet. I just want to make sure folks understand then that there's no insurance on this investment. I mean, there's a greater rate of return, but there is a greater level of risk. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for the record, I would say yes. A level that we feel is commensurate with responsible management, but as with any investment, we balance risk, return, term, et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And would you say that risk is due to the longer term and the longer time it takes to get the investment back out?
Mr. Chair,
or is it actually what you're investing in that's riskier?
Mr. Chair, I would defer to our investment experts on that, and the prospectus, which details very clearly exactly the type of investments that that we're going into. I can say, briefly, we have a lot of the same obligations of the United States government, very secure, but also there's going to be obligations of private issuers, which you get a better return, you get a longer term, you get a little more risk, but a little more return added onto that. And I want to stress that the word risk may carry some concerning connotations in some ways, but when we deal with investments day in and day out, that's just one of the natural ingredients that we have to balance with everything else. So I wouldn't want it to be suggested that risk automatically means a imprudent level.
Thank you. And one of the reasons chose not to move forward with a work session on this was precisely this conversation, wanting a little extra time to follow up with the Treasurer's Office to make sure everybody's comfortable. So we'll be able to do that hopefully off later when we come back to the work session.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one final question?
Okay, go ahead, Representative.
I just want to make sure that if there's $50 million of additional investment, that $50 million will share in the additional costs, fees, commissions, based on that money, and it's not going to be borne by other investors.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, for the record, that is true. The costs of maintaining the intermediate term pool will be borne by the participants of the intermediate term pool, and those risks are those costs are spread around the participants, and we are able to charge them according to statute for that service.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming down and giving us this testimony. It sounds like a good idea, and I just want to proceed a little more slowly with this at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2140 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2141, and maybe give our committee administrator a chance to tell us a little something about this bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Apologies, Mr. Chair. I don't have my
rather, I caught you up good.
Keeping me on my toes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2141 repeals the statute authorizing tax levy by county courts to support maintenance operations and construction of buildings on county fairgrounds and is effective on the 91st day after adjournment sine die.
Thank you. And up first, we have Lori Steele and Mike Eliason again.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Mike Eliason, Association of Oregon Counties. Again, this bill and the following bill hopefully are maybe a little bit more clear-cut than the last one, but both come out of the Government Efficiency Task Force as well. And in the course of working on some weightier proposals, it was also decided that maybe we could look at some of the existing statutes that are out there right now that are either obsolete or moot because of prior ballot measures, for example, that just were never cleaned out of statute that could possibly stand to be cleared out now. This particular bill, which deletes ORS 565-300, fits that bill. And again, I'll turn it over to Marion County Treasurer Lori Steele, who could sort of explain how this came about, how the treasurers discovered this particular statute.
Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon again, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. When I became a county treasurer elected 10 years ago, one of the first things I did was lock myself in my office and start reading statutes to see what I was statutorily responsible for, because everyone I asked gave me a different answer. We have 36 county treasurers, and it seems that we all play different roles in our counties depending on the size of the county. So as we started looking at the statutes, we wanted to come to some agreement on how we implement the statutes between from one county to another to make sure we are consistent. And we've come across several that seem to be, we are no longer able to implement, we can't follow because of other rules, because of changes in business, and this is one of them quite clearly that was brought up right away because of Measure 50 that was passed a few years ago for taxes. We can no longer follow this statute. So 565-330 is a statute that we cannot follow any longer. It is.
Thank you. And hate to be redundant and seemingly not efficient, but we do need you to introduce yourself again for the record.
Lori Steele, Marion County Treasurer. Again, I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Treasurers.
On each bill.
Thank you
for the record. Thank you. Committee, this any questions on this one? Seeing no questions, thank you very much for your testimony on this. And with that, I see no other buddy signed up to testify on this. See nobody else jumping up to run up here and testify on this one. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2141. And with that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2141. And
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2141 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2141 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Do I have any discussion? Seeing no discussion, I will ask for a roll call vote.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye. Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2141, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. Wouldn't anybody like to carry this complicated bill?
I will.
Vice Chair Lively, I'll let you go ahead and take this one.
Thank you.
You bet. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2141 and open a public hearing, or reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2142. Bob, would you like to give us a really brief summary of this bill?
Be thrilled to, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2142 repeals statutes requiring the county sheriffs to obtain receipts from county treasurers in specific circumstances, and repeals a statute requiring county treasurers to monthly deposit with the county clerk all county orders redeemed. This bill is also effective 91st day after adjournment sine die.
Thank you. And I wonder who's going to testify on this one. Oh, it's Mike Eliason and Lori Steele.
Chair Holby.
Thank you very much for testifying again. When you told me you were going to be in front of my committee a lot this session, I wasn't really expecting this.
Yeah, we'll try to keep it to a minimum for a while. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Mike Eliason, Association of Oregon Counties. Very quickly, this is also one more out of the Efficiency Task Force. Two statutes discovered by the county treasurers that appear to be from an era gone by. And again, Treasurer Steele can talk about how this was how these two statutes were discovered, and what actually goes on today at the county level. But again, in the interest of lightening the statutes a little bit, since we're adding hundreds more each session, we thought it would be good to clear out a couple that no longer are relevant. So, with that,
thank you. Lori Steele, Marion County Treasurer, representing the Oregon Association of Counties. Chair Holvey, members of the committee. These are two additional statutes that we have reviewed in detail, looking for ways to implement these statutes. We've taken them to various legal counsels in various counties to try to find out how we can comply with these statutes in this day and age, and we've really been unable to figure out a way to make these statutes work in the environment in which we live in today. There are other processes that are in place now to take care of the business that these statutes addressed when they were originally written, and it would be rather complicated to put into effect some of the requirements that are dictated under these statutes. Can I answer any questions for you?
We'll see. Any questions on this bill from the committee? No. I guess you can't answer any questions for us. I appreciate your testimony yet again, and thank you very much. I don't know if there's anybody else in the crowd that would like to testify on this particular House bill. Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2142 and open a work session on House Bill 2142.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2142 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2142 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and as with the last bill, I believe this bill also has no revenue and no fiscal impact. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. Statements of no revenue impact and no fiscal impact have been issued.
Thank you. Representative Lively moves House Bill 2142 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, can we have a Vote, please.
Representative Dougherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2143, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. That was House Bill 2142, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. Got ahead of myself. Do I have a volunteer for a carrier on this complicated bill? Normally, I would probably do these to the consent calendar, being so simple, but since these are our first bills, I thought we should carry them.
Just pick one.
Nobody's volunteering.
That's your bill, right? I will carry it.
Representative Dougherty, thank you. I don't like to demand somebody do something. So with that, House Bill 2142 is passed to the floor, and Representative Dougherty will be carrying. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 2142 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2143. Bob, will you revisit what this bill was about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2143 transfers the responsibility for inspecting local detention facilities from the Department of Corrections to local governments.
Thank you. This one we have some testimony on, so we're going to start out with Mitch Morrow. Good afternoon, welcome, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, or good afternoon, Mr. Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mitch Morrow. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Corrections. I will be brief. I had the pleasure of working with Representative Nathanson on the Government Efficiency Task Force. This came out, as you heard earlier, from that task force. The Department of Corrections currently does inspect jails. We are supportive of that responsibility moving to the sheriffs. We will continue to do inspections of lockups and juvenile facilities and things of that nature, but this was a redundant practice between the counties and the state, and we are fully supportive and believe that the sheriffs can handle this particular responsibility. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from committee? I think we've worn ourselves out, so you're off the hook for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I said for now. With that, up next is Becky Strauss and David Fedenke.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Becky Strauss with the ACLU of Oregon. Joining me is our executive director, David Fedenke. I asked him to come along as a lifeline, so I'm going to cue it up and then kick it over to Dave. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. We do want to take a moment and recognize the work of the Government Efficiency Task Force and for Representative Nathanson's participation on that. We think it's good work, and we're supportive of making the operations of government more efficient and cost-effective and less redundant. We spotted an issue with the bill that we did bring to her, and I do want to also express my gratitude to Representative Nathanson for listening to those concerns and allowing us to draft the amendment that I is the dash one. I hope you all have it. Many of you probably have not had a chance to review, so I'll talk a little bit about that. Our concern is what has happened with this bill is we've moved from a government efficiency issue to now a government transparency problem, and I think it can be addressed with the dash one amendment. Our concern is that currently what happens is oftentimes when the local governments do contract, what happens is when the local governments do conduct the jail inspections, they're contracting with the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself. what we're losing is some access to valuable information, including the standards and criteria by which the Sheriff's Association uses to evaluate the jails when they conduct the audits. So what our amendment does, and I've also included with the written testimony a copy, a sample jail inspection report. What we've seen with some of the Sheriff's Association evaluations is that while they are a group performing a public function and evaluating our public facilities, the public receives very little by way of information in terms of, as I said, the standards and criteria they're using to evaluate the jails. And then the report that we see will oftentimes reference the criteria that we don't have access to. So a few things that the amendment would do, it would say that when a local government does contract, or really whoever it is that is performing the jail inspection, should make available the standards and criteria that they're using. In my written testimony, I under my second bullet point, I say the standards and criteria for such inspection are more comprehensive than those in the current statutory standards that DOC uses. The language of the amendment, and we're supportive of this language, is just that the standards meet or exceed the current statutory standards. So that's great. That the standards and criteria then be provided to the Department of Corrections, and that a complete copy of the findings and recommendations of such inspection also be provided to the department. In our amendment, we put in 45 days, if that's amenable to the committee. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to take a look at the amendment. As I said, really our interest here is ensuring that the public has access to this work that is done in our public facilities. The state is spending money on the audits. We're spending money, of course, on housing the inmates and running the jails, and I think we all have a right to know what the inspection finds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. And I want to just give a little bit more, put a little bit more flesh on the bones of the Sheriff's Association inspections of local jails, what is known and what isn't known about them. This is a program that was set up by the Sheriff's Association, which is a private nonprofit organization, on a volunteer basis. And I expect you will hear about that very shortly from their representative. We have asked for copies of their inspection standards. They have refused to provide them to the ACLU or to anyone else voluntarily. I understand they have been required to turn over those standards in the course of litigation. The ACLU is not involved in any of that litigation, and I hope we won't have to be. But these are public facilities, county jails. And as Ms. Strauss mentioned, the state a number of years ago agreed to pay counties for housing convicted defendants who have been convicted of some felony crimes, rather than have those inmates be transferred to state facilities. So the state has an interest in the operation of local jails, other than just an interest of good government. State funds are supporting the operation of these jails in parts, although obviously the counties bear the brunt of those costs. We don't think it is a good trade-off to have a public system be taken over by a private system and then be done in secret beyond the reach of the members of the public and beyond the reach of this legislature when public funds are paying for these operations. Our amendments, the Dash One amendments, are designed to cure this problem and still allow the consolidation of these inspections for the state to turn over that responsibility when the inspections are actually going to occur. As you heard earlier, the Sheriff's Association does not inspect city jails. It does not inspect, like the city jail in Springfield, Representative Lively, or local lockup facilities that are often at police department headquarters or juvenile facilities. Our amendment is drafted in a way to fix that problem with the initial bill so that the DOC's responsibility would only go away if an inspection was done by a local government. And the other problem the amendments are designed to cure is to bring some sunshine to the process of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association inspections. We understand that they are opposed to that, and we're interested in hearing more about why they are opposed and why they feel it is so important that their standards and the details of their inspections be kept secret. That's all we have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So just real briefly, the standards that you speak of are currently available that the Department of Corrections uses?
Yes. Well, they're in the statute. There are some other statutory obligations that the department has to provide consultation and advice.
So if those standards were made available by the sheriffs, and would that address your basic problem?
I think the question is which standards. We would like to see all of the standards,
mm-hmm.
So that they could be evaluated publicly. Since we have not been able to analyze those standards, we have no idea if they're adequate. We know that the current standards in statute are extremely outdated and haven't been revisited by the legislature in an exceedingly long time.
Assuming that the standards were adequate and you were able to publicly, those were public, what would be the reason for sending those reports back to the Department of Corrections if the sheriffs already had them?
So there would be a central repository for them, Mr. Chair. One of the problems...
Not a central...
Well, I can get into details. I don't know if you have the time today, but...
Well, we're not going to move the bill today. I was just...
In the case of one jail, we have been looking into the operations of one jail in preparation to issue a public report on the operations of that one jail. We made a public records request for some documents, including a copy of their policy manual guiding the operations of the facility. After many months, we got a copy of a portion of the operations manual for that jail. The sheriff withheld large portions of their operations manual for security reasons, but refused to even give us a copy of the table of contents of their operations manual.
Thank you. And I will say that the committee, at least I haven't anyway, seen these amendments yet. We don't really have them.
My apologies for that, Mr. Chair.
I know they just got finished drafting. And,
right.
And Representative Nathanson has also requested an amendment, which we do not have at this point. And it sounds like there may be even another one potentially. So I appreciate you flagging this for us and bringing your issues forward and testifying on this. Is there any other questions from the committee for this panel?
Quick comment, Mr. Chair. I think this is really appropriate because it's one thing to have an organization be responsible for their own inspection, but if there's no requirement that the results be published, you don't always know what quality or timeliness you're getting. And so I think it's a good idea that we do have greater transparency.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Up next, we have Patrick Singh from the Association of Oregon counties.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Patrick Singh with the Association of Oregon Counties here supporting House Bill 2143 and the work of the Efficiency Task Force, which we certainly appreciate Representative Nathanson's leadership on. The Criminal Justice Subcommittee of that task force was represented by a wide range of county, city, and state interests, just to name a few to give you the diversity, chaired by Yamhill County Commissioner Mary Stern, our AOC President for the year, Columbia County District Attorney Steve Atchison, Wayne County Government Affairs, Alex Kyler, Faye Fagel from Marion County Juvenile Department, Laura Lee McKee, a Deputy District Attorney in Lane County, Dave Nelson, former Troutdale Police Chief and now with City County Insurance, which provides liability insurance for a majority of cities and counties in Oregon, Jason Myers, Marion County Sheriff, Kiki Parker-Rose, Klamath County Community Corrections, and Scott Taylor from Multnomah County Community Corrections. So you can see it was a very diverse panel, studied a number of issues and recommended three that relate to public safety, this being one of them, the duplication of county jail audits, which both the Department of Corrections and the State Sheriff's Association do, as we have discussed already. So the Department of Corrections, when they do their audit, they are bound by 14 sets of standards that are defined in statute, in the statute that we're discussing today. The Sheriff's Association audit covers those 14 standards plus an additional few hundred. There's 309 total standards that the State Sheriff's Association audit their jails on, and Daryl Fuller from the Association of State Sheriffs will talk more about that. This is one of our top priorities for the AOC Public Safety Committee, made up of county commissioners, sheriffs, district attorneys, community corrections folks that use the jail on a regular basis. We do have our own amendment that we are sharing with the State Sheriff's Association's, the Dash 2, I don't know if that's before you or not, but it clarifies that this bill will only be for county jails. The bill was written a little vague, and so there was a question of whether or not DOC would still audit other local facilities like juvenile departments, so county jails specifically. And then the other piece of the amendment does talk about the public disclosure, in that the Sheriff's Association will make public the current 14 standards that are required under statute. So those 14 standards that are currently being audited will continue to be sent to the, or will now be sent to the Department of Corrections and available to the public. I can just say as a, and there are a number of reasons why going above and beyond that, which could be another issue on another day, but there are definite safety concerns that would be revealed if that were to go further and made available to the public, officer safety issues as well as community safety. I can say as a, you know, with my AOC hat off as a sworn reserve police officer in Portland, we take people to the county jail on a regular basis, and there are a number of things about county jails that you would not want to release to the public. A lot of those safety issues are covered in the Sheriff's Association audit, which is beneficial to sheriffs as they improve their own jails, but may not be appropriate for public disclosure. So we are in support of the Dash 2 amendments that would be presented. I think this is a unique opportunity for state and county to continue our partnership, increase efficiency in challenging budget times, and certainly urge the committee's approval. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and of course we haven't seen the Dash 2 quite yet, so I appreciate your testimony on this, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Or maybe I should ask if there are any questions for this testifier. Not at this time. We might get a second chance later. With that, Daryl Fuller, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. One of the advantages to signing up late is that everything's already been said, so I will hope to keep my remarks brief. We have the Dash 37 amendments that I think will be here in a day or so that we hope that you guys will support. The Government Efficiency Task Force did a great job in coming up with a small idea that would save a little bit of money. It was a duplicated audit. The sheriffs were doing an audit. Department of Corrections were doing an audit. Our audit covered the same things that their audit covered. So the notion was, let's eliminate one of those two audits. It was never the Government Efficiency Task Force intent, nor our desire, that the results of that audit be shielded from the public. Those audits that are conducted by the Department of Corrections are available to the public, and the sheriff's support amendments that would make it really clear that on those portions of the audit that are required by statute, that we would make that information available to the Department of Correction, and that the public is getting everything tomorrow that they're getting that they got yesterday. We have absolutely no problem with providing that information to the public. We're proud of our jails and the job that they do. The objection we have to the amendments that have been drafted by the ACLU is that they are intending to use the bill that eliminates a duplication of audits to expand the scope of the audit that is required by statute by requiring the association's audit, which covers over 300 points and standards, that entire audit would then have to be released to the public simply because we're reducing the duplication of an audit that's done by the state. If it is the opinion of the ACLU that the points in statute, the standards in statute, are antiquated or insufficient, then let's have that discussion, and they may be right. But this is not the vehicle to have that discussion. This vehicle is reducing the duplications of an audit. We will ensure that they get the same information that they've always had, but expanding the scope of the audit simply because we're trying to save a little bit of money for the state of Oregon simply isn't the conversation that we believe is appropriate in this bill. We should change that statute and expand it if that's what the ACLU wants to do, and we're happy to have that conversation. The amendment that should eventually reach your offices will make it really clear that this is a county jail only issue. The original drafting expanded it to all local government holding facilities, which was never anybody's intent. We hope that the amendment that you eventually get will make it really clear that the Department of Corrections will get from the Oregon State Sheriff's Association the exact same information that they've been getting when they conduct their own audits. We'll provide that same information, but does not obligate the sheriffs to provide any of the information beyond the scope of what's required by statute when we do our own internal audits, which is an effort by the association and the individual sheriffs to make sure that best practices in a number of areas are being done by sheriffs across the state. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Fuller, I'm now catching on. By DOC no longer doing an audit which had 300 points, the sheriffs now can do their own audit, which in one instance at least had 14 points.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, that's not correct. The Department of Correction audit covers 14 points. That's all the statute requires, and that's what the Department of Corrections reviews, is 14 points. All right. The sheriffs on their own, because we have what's called a command council, all our jail commanders meet on a regular basis to talk about best practices and how to best run their jails. Over time, that what are you doing in your county, how is that working, is that a good idea, became a process where we were actually inspecting one another's jails to help one another create good standards and efficiencies. So we have created over time our own inspection process, internal inspection process, done by the association with over 300 points and standards. It covers the 14 points that the state is already auditing. So rather than have the state come in and audit just 14 of those points again, what this bill will do is allow the sheriffs to take the audit that we've already conducted, that 300 plus point audit, take out those 14 points that are required by statute, and provide that information to the Department of Corrections so they don't have to do their own audit. what the ACLU would like to do with their amendments is require us to not give those 14 points to the Department of Corrections, but to release our entire 300-point audit to the Department of Corrections because we're trying to save them a little bit of money. And we don't believe that that's an appropriate expansion in this bill.
Would not the 300 points be a public document anyway?
It is not a public document. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, it is done by a private association, and it's done, and I don't have the specifics other than the information is not currently public.
My only thought is it is public money that's paying for it.
The Oregon State Sheriff's Association is a privately funded nonprofit association.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Just a clarification on what Representative Richardson was saying. Thank you. So right now, if the sheriff's, I mean, you could just revert back to the 14-point inspection. I mean, you could choose to, and that would all be all that is required to be released.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, nothing in our 300-point standards is required by statute. No, we could eliminate that entire program and simply comply with the 14 points in statute and do nothing in addition to that if necessary.
Okay.
Representative Thatcher.
And the criteria, is there anything with, I mean, like, for example, is there something like, okay, is there a, dust on the windowsill. I don't know what you got, but is it so the criteria has to be kept like not revealed or just the results, because as previous testimony was stating, there could be a safety issue. You could be revealing a weak point or something, and that could be taken advantage of by inmates. Is that kind of
Chair Holy Representative Thatcher? The document that we've created over time is a copyrighted document that we have legal ownership over and simply don't prefer as an internal document to release it to the public. It covers not only inmate safety and security, but their access to material, their access to visits, and like I said, a lot of these are covered under the statute, and then there's an expansive list that's not covered under statute that we simply do as best practices. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair, I guess what my question was is, you've got 309 points of criteria, minus the 14. 14, that's part of the statute. You go above and beyond with another almost 300 more additional criteria, but you cannot reveal what the criteria is. Is that the objection, or is it the objection of the results that could compromise safety, perhaps because it's revealing a weak point or not, but it's revealing something that could be taken advantage of to detriment by inmates? Is that
Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher, based on the testimony previously from Mr. Fedenke, I would assume, because I haven't asked the association whether they are interested in parsing out what part they would or won't release, is that it has been the policy of the association to simply not produce any of it. So I would assume that it's not only the standard itself, but whether or not the jails are complying with that standard. But I'll check to see whether or not that's accurate.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So even though you're a private nonprofit institution, you'd be receiving public money to perform these inspections. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Vega Peterson, I don't have the answer to that question, because I know that we're a privately funded nonprofit association. Whether the individual counties pay money to have that done, or whether it's part of the association's nonprofit money that does that, I don't have the answer to that, but I can get it for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I just have one quick question before we move on. The thing I'm curious about is, are you required to do audits at the sheriff's level? I mean, absent that state law of 14, which now is performed by the Department of Corrections, do the counties, are they required to do audits on the jails?
Chair Holvey, there might be a federal requirement that we simply apply at the state level. I'm not aware of any county requirements, but individual counties may have their own requirements. I don't know on a county-by-county level.
Do the state statutes require you to do an audit?
The state statutes require the Department of Corrections to do an audit. There isn't an independent statute requiring the counties to do one as well.
Thank you.
It currently is a state function.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just very quickly, I have utmost respect for our sheriffs. I actually spoke to my Union County Sheriff last night, but something just doesn't sit right with me on this. I'm trying to figure out what's the value of an audit if the audit isn't available for inspection. Help me understand what I'm missing.
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, as I understand, the sort of the genesis of the audit was initially, again, just jail commanders sharing information and best practices and finding ways to help one another improve the system based on things that they've learned in their own counties and things that perhaps they're learning from counties in other states. And over time, that became a growing list of things that we were looking at to make sure that the jails were doing the best they could in areas far beyond what was required by statute. And so we have staff from other jails that come in and audit a jail, so it's not a county's not auditing itself. It's jail staff from other counties that come in and do the review, and the intent there is to make sure, and then that information is provided to the sheriff to make sure that he knows if there are any deficiencies in the county, where they are at, so he can make those corrections.
Just a quick follow-up, if I may. Mm-hmm. So if statutorily the authority that DOC currently has is transferred to our sheriffs, wouldn't it logically assume then that the information that's gathered would become public information?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith.
I know as past chair of Public Safety Ways and Means, at any point in time I could call DOC and say, I want to see XYZ audit, and they brought it forward. So I'm just struggling with that. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, the state requires of us an audit of 14 points. And that audit is already done. By transferring the requirement to do that audit to the county, again, we're not objecting to making sure that that audit is available to the state and to public, you know, public review and public scrutiny. What we're objecting to at this point is transferring that ability to do the audit at the local level to save the state money, that function in itself should expand the nature of the audit and the information that's available by a, you know, hundreds of points, because right now we're doing those audits, but we don't. Those are things we don't have to do by statute.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Representative Kinnegar.
Okay. So just building on, thank you, Mr. Chair, building on everyone else's comments here, I think that the answer to Representative Vega Peterson's would be key in this, because if there are state funds that are going to fund the sheriff's investigation, some of that is for the 14 mandated pieces that then become public, but the rest of it, almost 300, as Representative Thatcher said, are things that you've chosen to do for best practice, which I applaud you for. But I think if we're not able to see what are the criteria that you're using, then we lack the oversight that Representative Richardson asked about is this where we want to be spending state money? Do we care about dust on the windowsill, or are there other significant things? So I think that the question of whether state funds are being used, whether we think your 300 are excessive or appropriate, is an appropriate question.
Representative Vega Pearson.
Did you want to respond? I'm sorry.
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnegar, I don't know if there was a question in there. If there was, I missed it. We're being asked to do, this bill is asking us to perform a function that the state is currently doing.
Right.
And we don't have any problem with doing that. Again, if the concern of the committee is we want to have an expanded list of criteria for the jails to be audited, then the statute that lists the criteria is what ought to be amended, mm-hmm. not using sort of the vehicle that we have before us as a way to expand the list without having that discussion of what should or shouldn't be there. Right. We're happy to have that discussion about what ought to and not be on that list, but to have us perform a 14-point audit function and to sort of extrapolate that into opening up that entire list of whether it's appropriate or not appropriate, it just seems to me that it's apples and oranges, and we're happy to have that other discussion. It just doesn't seem to us that this is the vehicle to do that.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and all the questions. I think we have a pretty good understanding of the issue before us, and we're going to have to hash out the amendments and have another discussion later on about this. So I appreciate you coming forward and explaining the sheriff's position. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2143. And I'm going to skip in the agenda. Normally, when a state representative comes in, we let them go first, and I wasn't sure what the protocol was for former state representatives, but I'm going to open a public hearing for House Bill 2609 and call forward former state representative Steve March, the Multnomah County Auditor. Oh, go ahead and give us a little brief summary, if you would.
Bob. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2609 deletes the requirement that certain audits of counties include circuit courts and has an emergency clause and is effective on passage.
Welcome, and thank you. I know you wanted to sit through and see how government efficiency works as a brief primer for your auditing back in the county level.
Well, thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. It was an exciting afternoon. Anytime we're talking government efficiency, auditors are pleased. So, and that's actually what I'm here for as well.
And if you remember the protocol, you introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. For the record, my name is Steve March. I'm a Multnomah County Auditor, and when I first took office, I ran across a document that had been prepared by Legislative Council about mandates to counties. And one of the mandates that was listed was that counties perform audits of circuit courts. And I thought, uh-oh, we're not doing that. So I did a little research on that issue and found that that section of the Municipal Audit Code was created in 1977, and the courts at that time were county courts with county personnel, and the county was responsible indeed for auditing them. In 1981, during a special session, those circuit courts were moved to be under the state chief justice and the judicial department, and there was a two-year phase-in period, but nobody ever bothered to go back and clean up this one little section that under law requires us to do audits of the circuit courts. Fortunately, we haven't done that, and no citizen has come to me and said, why aren't you following state law? If we were mandated to do this, first of all, I'd probably get slapped with contempt of court if I walked in waving 297-515 along with my external auditors. But if we did do this, it would probably cost us well over $100,000 a year, and every county would also have to do it as well. So currently, the state audits division does audit the circuit courts as part of the judicial judicial department audit, and so this in practice doesn't affect anything. It just takes that error out of the state ORS. And with that, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions from the committee? Representative March, did you actually vote on that bill way back then?
No, I only look like I did. So.
Well,
Chair Holby, this may be the easiest bill he's ever gotten through the system.
Well, I'll take that as a good sign, Representative Richardson.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony on this and making the trip down just so somebody could explain it to us. And you're a good guy to do it. And it's good to see you again.
All right.
And safe travels back to Portland.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2609, and I believe we have the fiscal impact statements for this, so we could move that. Is that correct, Bob?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. We have statements of no revenue impact and no fiscal impact for this bill.
So with that, I'll look for a motion.
Did you open a work session?
No, did I open a work session? Let's open a work session for House Bill 2609. Good catch, Vice Chair.
Thank you. Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2609 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2609 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, could we have a vote, Samantha?
Yes. Representative Doherty.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye. House Bill 2609, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor. Volunteers for...
I would love to. I actually sponsored that bill, and I'm very proud to say that Steve March is my former legislator, so I'd be honored to carry this on the floor.
I can tell you things about him, and with that, Representative Kenny Geyer will be the carrier, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2609. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2211.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, Sarah Miller, Deputy Chief Operating Officer, Department of Administrative Services. I was with you on Tuesday. I'll be back with you on Tuesday. You're going to be so excited to hear from me.
And thank you for waiting.
I have with me Julie Pearson-Ruthven, who is the Interim State Chief Information Officer, who's here to answer any questions that you might throw my way. In the spirit of the bills that you've heard before, the House Bill 2211 is about removing two outdated committees that relate to IT governance in state government. So ORS 291038 defines two management advisory bodies that have specific membership requirements. The first, Information Resource Management Council, was created to provide DAS with policy direction and coordination of IT implementations for state government services. The second body, the Stakeholders Advisory Committee, was created really as an opportunity for our customers of IT services to have opportunity to interact, particularly as it related, and this will give you a sense of the age, about integrated video conferencing and statewide online access user fees back in the days when you had to pay to actually get internet access available to you. These two bodies both last formally met in the year 2000. We've changed IT governance as technology has evolved and management of the enterprise has evolved. We have taken the missions of these two committees and reassigned their purposes. Those have evolved over the last 13 years, and what I'm going to tell you about is how we meet these obligations today. So there's a sort of long sorted history that we could play out for you, except what I think you really care about is how do we fulfill those statutory obligations. So first, right now, we use the Enterprise Leadership Team. The Chief Operating Officer hosts a management team comprised of agency directors of the 20 largest state agencies and representatives of the four statewide elected officials in a body that provides policy direction, leadership, and oversight of state government operations. We include in the purview of the Enterprise Leadership Team information technology policies. It's the place where we would take any draft statewide policies that we were putting out for operational perspective for vetting by business operations. Number two, I mentioned when I was before you you. On Tuesday, we have customer advisory boards that oversee the service side of our organization. And so we have a large component of the Department of Administrative Services that provides technology infrastructure services and application development for statewide applications to state agencies. The Enterprise Technology Services Enterprise has a customer utility board, which has stakeholder representation, which means agency representatives from customer agencies, both inside state government and at local government levels where we have local government customers participate. So we believe that these two bodies help us fulfill the statutory obligations required by the Information Resource Management Council and the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. House Bill 2211 removes the statutory requirement for those two specific bodies, but continues to require the leadership, policy implementation, and oversight. It gives my office flexibility in terms of how to implement those objectives most effectively, but doesn't remove our responsibility to provide the policy guidance from an implementation perspective across state agency bounds. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions on House Bill 2211. Representative Thatcher.
So just curious. You added right then, sort of clarifying some of my question, but the enterprise leadership team and customer advisory boards are not going to be later removed from statute because you, I mean, so it sounds like you are able to just kind of appoint this and create these things in rule now rather than have them statutorily.
Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher, both of these bodies are actually within the purview of the director of the Department of Administrative Services. So as we talked about when I was with you on Tuesday, DAS has the role of convener in chief. And so it's our job to standardize, maybe even homogenize things that get implemented across. And so we still will have the statutory obligation to make sure this work happens. We will take out the reference to the name of the body that does the work so that as our model changes over time to continue to evolve, you won't be seeing me in 10 more years talking about I'd like to change the name of that committee. We'll own the obligation, be flexible about how it's implemented.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the roster for the Enterprise Leadership Team, and the heads of other departments and other staff members of the executive branch, it looks like. Am I correct that on either or both of these, there were outside members that were not just part of the executive branch?
Representative Holvey, Representative Richardson, for the membership of the Enterprise Leadership Team, that's not the case. In the governor's budget process, which I think you might be referring to, when we did the work as an improving government program funding team, there were only state agency representatives. In all the other functional areas, the governor asked and appointed third-party participants to be involved. And so you are correct that the original statutory reference to the Stakeholders Advisory Committee had outside private citizen representative requirement. We were immensely unsuccessful in convincing high-tech people to come and help us do IT policy at the statewide level. In the booming information technology era. And so, you know, if it was important to this body that we continue to have private citizen representation, we have flexibility in some of our governance models to do that. It wouldn't happen at the Enterprise Leadership Team, though. That's really the management team that the COO uses for state government operations.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm not seeing anything. Thank you for your presentation. Committee, I believe we do have the ability to move this bill forward with the fiscal impact statement and revenue statement being done. Is that correct, Bob?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. No fiscal impact, no revenue impact for House Bill 2211.
Representative Wiley, would you like to make a motion? Oh, I got to close the public hearing. I'm sorry. Close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2211.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2211 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2211 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, could we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Excuse?
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2609, having received the proper votes, House Bill 2211, having received the proper votes, is passed the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we'll have Representative Vega Peterson carry that bill, and with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2211. In committee, we will stand adjourned.